Okay, this is now talk 10 on how to identify and handle wicked people. I've been going quite slowly today compared to what I expected, but I always tend to overestimate what I can do. So let's carry on looking at different ways in which we've been able to identify the wicked, but now we're looking at deception and deceivers in particular. So, another point is develop the technique of checking and double-checking and triple-checking the things you were told. Sounds obvious. Most of the things that I say and the Bible says are obvious, but they're not done. People don't do this. And so you need to start as a matter of routine to make it your default setting that you will check and double-check and even triple-check what you're told. Don't just believe what you're told. And make that your standard policy all the time. Not just when you feel suspicious, but even when things are told to you that you're not suspicious about. Just make it your habit to automatically check things. Don't take things at face value. Because the things that a person says to you, there could be a lie by that person. Often it is a lie. Or it could be that that person is innocently repeating a lie which was told to them, which they didn't check. Now, can you see how convincing it is when a person repeats a lie? Because this is the point. When the person repeats the lie, they say it with sincerity, with conviction. They're not lying to you. They're telling you something that's a lie, but they're not lying to you. And that makes it all the more convincing. And that's one of the distinct possibilities, that what you're being told, albeit that the person saying it to you is a sincere person whom you trust, they may well be that. But they're telling you something that is a lie that they never checked. You see how dangerous that is? Because your guard is lowered because it's being told to you by Mr. James Brown, who's a real friend of yours. And James Brown, you know that he's trustworthy, totally honest. And he's saying this thing to you. Well, therefore, you can believe it. No, you can't therefore believe it because he might have been lied to. And that has to be at the forefront of your mind as a distinct possibility. Because there are so many lies going around about all sorts of things. It's not an exceptional or strange situation when a lie is told. It's just utterly normal. I don't know what percentage of the things that are said are lies, but it's a high percentage. So it's completely normal. So let that be your working assumption, that the people who speak to you, just assume they haven't checked anything that they're saying. They haven't checked a thing that they're passing on. They're just passing it on unchecked. Assume it's your job to check it. Don't assume that anything comes to you ready checked. It almost certainly comes to you not checked. Now, when I ran a law firm, I developed the art of checking and double checking, and I told staff that they were welcome to report any concern to me that they wanted to report, and I would listen entirely to what they were saying. But I used to say, I will not take any action based on what you say until I have checked it and double checked it and triple checked it, whatever it is that you might allege. Now, saying that and making sure that people know that you mean it, it acts as an important safeguard. So it creates a disincentive on their part to tell you a lie, because they know you're going to check things. So making it known that you're going to do that will cause fewer lies to be told to you. It won't stop lies being told to you, but there'll be fewer. But also that precaution is necessary for your own sake to prevent you acting in an overly hasty way. So if you say to the world, I'm going to check and double check and triple check any allegation made to me, let that be your assurance to the world and to yourself. If you do that, then you're protecting yourself. You're preventing yourself from, you're protecting yourself, from your own over hastiness. You're preventing yourself leaping into action based on a false report or exaggerated report or even a mistaken report or even an innocently reported lie from someone else. You're preventing yourself acting on it. It has the effect of slowing you down, prevents you making rash decisions. Now, again, wouldn't you agree that's totally obvious that you should do all this? But how many people actually do any of that? Very, very few. Say that or do that or practice that. Very few. Therefore, some of us believe things far too quickly and accept negative allegations about other people without question, even when they're based on one person's word. Now, if people get to know that you don't check things, which is a pretty reasonably safe working assumption on their part anyway, since hardly anybody checks anything. But if they get to know that you don't check things, you're virtually asking to be deceived. They'll soon realise they can get you to act hastily in reliance on what they tell you. And in a law firm, in any business, staff will deliberately tell you lies about other staff in the hope that you'll do something, take some rash, unjustified action. And in that way, you might react prematurely without checking anything. And then you'll be the agent by whom, by which, they can undermine or take out some rival that they see as a threat or a rival in the business. So if you're running a business, people will lie to you to get you to deal with someone whom they see as a threat or a rival. And you have to realize that. They'll do that in a church, they'll do that in a business, they'll do that anywhere. And so that is why, that's one of the many reasons why you need to double check things, triple check things, and let people know that you're going to. Because if they know you're going to check everything, they'll think twice about lying to you. Now, having said that, and that's an important point to make, having said all of that, it's also very important that you should always at least be willing to listen to any allegation, however unlikely it may sound, and even if it comes from only one person. Because my point is this, you should listen to it. My point is simply that you should not act upon it. So don't confuse listening to with acting upon. Those are two totally different things. You should be willing to listen to anyone's complaint or concern, but just don't act on it. You just park it, you just take note of it, and then you decide at a later point whether you have obtained the requisite amount of evidence to convince you that you can act upon it. But that is a decision for later. Right, now here's a technique you can use, which I learned about in the police force, about how to know whether people are lying and when they're lying and what they're lying about. Where are the lies in their story? Because someone could tell you a story and it's 94% true. It could be 99% true. But it's still a lie, because it contains a lie. And it's this. Look at the person's eyes while they're talking. And at the moments when they break eye contact is where they're probably lying to you. So they watch them as they're speaking to you. So if you're in an interview room in the police force, you do this all the time. But it's not only in police forces and interview rooms that such conversations are to be had. You'll have them in a workplace, you'll have them in a church, you'll have them in your own private life with people saying things to you. And you then talk to them, question them, use this technique. Look into their face, look into their eyes when they're telling you the story, and watch for the times when their eyes look down to the table or break eye contact, and note, what are they talking about at the precise moments that they do that? Now, the thing is, unless the person is a really accomplished liar, a real fraudster, a real trained confidence trickster, or a spy, or a utter, you know, completely trained con artist, they can't avoid looking away or breaking eye contact just at the very moment of the lie in the story. Of course, if they're a really hardened villain and they have no conscience left whatsoever, they can probably manage to look you straight in the eye throughout the whole time and never flinch. But you'll probably find other ways of knowing whether they're a hardened villain of that kind. So this test is useful for what this test does. And this test is useful for those who still have some residue of a functioning conscience. If they have none at all, if you were talking to Dr. Goebbels, this wouldn't work with Dr. Goebbels. But it would work with some of the people that you work with or go to church with. Now, if ever you watch police interviews and things on the telly, Jack Frost is... Have you ever seen A Touch of Frost with Jack Frost? Anyway, his interview technique, he paces about in the interview room and he's sort of banging his fist and looking out the window and looking across and looking this way. He spends hardly any time looking into the suspect's eyes as he's interviewing him. And I think that's not good technique. You need to be watching their eyes. It might make better television to do what he does. But he's missing out on the opportunity to be guided by that factor. And remember, I keep emphasizing this, each of these is a factor. You can't just base your entire discernment on a single test or a single issue or a single measurement. You need to measure a lot of things, all the things that you're capable of measuring on that occasion. Take them all into account, and this is one of them. So, generally speaking, unless the person is a complete villain, they will look away or break eye contact, even momentarily, at certain points in the story, and you need to record, remember them. When did they do it? It was the bit where they mentioned this. So the story is like this, you see. True, 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 lie, true, 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 lie, true, true. And you need to know, when did they look away? Because why would the person make up a completely fabricated story that never, absolutely everything's a lie? The chances of them being able to convince you of that or get away with it are small. So what they'll do is have a story that's 96% true and 4% a lie. But that 4% is profoundly important in changing the whole meaning of the entire story. And you need to find, where is it in the story? Now, there is an exception to this, where sometimes even an innocent person will break eye contact or look away from you, and they'll often do it if they've had some trauma, or they've been a victim of, say, a sexual assault, or if they feel a sense of shame. If they feel violated or degraded, they'll look away. They're not lying to you, but they just have a deep sense of shame, and they look away from you. But the point is that the looking away that is done by such a person tends to be a little different. It tends to be more sustained. It's not just momentary glancing away from you, breaking eye contact. It's looking down and feeling ashamed, and that's different. So don't confuse that, which you can come across. Don't confuse that with the momentary glancing away when the lie is told in a story. And I remember once, as a solicitor, I did hardly any matrimonial type work, but when I was a trainee solicitor, I had to do just a few matrimonial cases just to say I'd done them. I did six. And there was one case I dealt with. It was by a man who was being a battered husband. He was being battered by his wife. The strange thing was, he was 6'4". And he was being battered by this shrew of a wife that he'd never managed to tame. Anyway, this wife that was beating him. And when he was telling me the story, he came to see me about it. And he'd be looking down, and just like this, he felt ashamed of his story. But yet he needed something doing about it. But he was telling me the story, but he felt ashamed. Now, he wasn't lying to me. So his looking away and looking down wasn't based on dishonesty. It was based on shame. Just be aware of that. Now, that is an alternative explanation, but it doesn't look quite the same anyway. Another technique for finding where the lies are is to ask the person to tell their story repeatedly. To tell it, and what you'll find is, if the person is lying, they will tell it slightly differently each time. And so you'll get the person to go through it, and then later that day or on another day, get them to go through it again, and then get them to go through it again. Or you may want to take them through it in a different order, or you may want to focus in on particular parts of the story. And what you've got to do is have a very precise, accurate memory of what they've said. That's why it's a good idea to record interviews, even if it's in a workplace or in a church meeting. Record it with the person's consent. I don't mean without their consent. And I advocate this because if the person won't let you record it, well, why won't they let you record it? They need to give a good reason. The thing is, you need to be capable of going back later and checking and double checking and triple checking. Don't explain to the person why you're doing it. Just say, now it's okay if I record this, I need to just have a record of everything that's said. And one thing I would say to people is, it saves me writing notes the whole time. Because the alternative is to sit there writing notes the whole time. Well, if you're writing notes the whole time, you can't be looking at them. It also makes the interview much slower. And I simply say, this is not telling a lie, that by recording the interview, it precludes the need for me to take notes, which is very tiresome. It also makes the interview much quicker. It also means I've got a record and I don't have to write it all down. But you don't need to say, and I also want to use this to check out afterwards whether you're a liar. You don't need to mention that. You just don't mention that. But the point is this. If you do it, then you can check each time what was the story. Now, this is the thing. That if the person is a liar, they are retrieving the details of what they say from a quite different part of their memory. So the memory of real events that really, really happened, or that really were said, or really happened, are remembered in a particular way, in a particular part of your memory. But the memory of things you made up, the memory of stories you invented, the memory of conversations you've pretended to have but never really had, events that you've said happened but they never really happened, they are remembered in a different way. What is it that you're remembering? Here, you're trying to remember what you said. And that's quite different from trying to remember what happened, what really happened. It's remembered in a different part of your memory, and it's remembered much less accurately than what happened or what really was said. So you have a vivid recollection of what was really said or really happened, especially if it's significant. Not if it's something that's utterly mundane, perhaps not. But if it's something of some significance, you'll remember it with some vividness. But if it's something you've made up, or you're lying about or exaggerating, the precise details of what you alleged may not be remembered very well, because they're not remembered in the same place or in the same way or by the same software that God put into us for remembering real things. And that's why a person who's lying, he has to rely on this second-rate memory of the lies he's told. And when you ask him to tell the story again, and then you ask him to tell the story again, each time there's just these little slight discrepancies in the story, because he's retrieving these facts and figures from that inferior part of his memory on what never really happened at all. Whereas the truthful person is taking retrieving facts from their real memory. Truthful people will be consistent each time. They're just telling you what happened again and again and again. They tell you the same story. They're not having to make an effort to remember, because it's just obvious. They just know what happened. But there's another feature that makes it more difficult for the liar. And that is that liars tend to find it almost impossible to resist embroidering the story, adding little bits. So as they go along, they just add things. So it's not just that they can't remember what they said last time, though that's a big part of it. They also have a tendency to want to add, to embroider, just to make up lies that aren't needed, because they just like doing it. So partly it's because they think that embroidering adds authenticity, because they think that the more detailed I can make the story, the more convincing it becomes. It's actually the opposite. The more they add unnecessary detail of that type, the more they hang themselves. And so one person who does this is Hillary Clinton. It sounds like I've got it in for the American presidential candidates today. But Hillary Clinton is a person who is an habitual liar. She's just a liar by her nature. She's a liar. She's just continually telling lies all the time. And so she, for example, was interviewed once and started talking about how she went to an airport and had to run across the tarmac because she was under sniper fire. So somebody pulled out film of this incident where she allegedly ran across the airport tarmac under sniper fire, and it's all a complete pack of lies. She just embroidered the whole story because she wanted to be impressive, perhaps, but I think it was deeper than that. I think it was partly just that she's just a pathological continual liar. And she just lies for the sake of it. No need to. There was no need to tell that lie. It got her into a lot of trouble. But it's a testimony to the way in which the American people have declined, that it doesn't bother them much that she told that lie or any of the other lies that she told. She's still leading in the polls on the Democratic side. It doesn't seem to bother them. But the thing is this. She told that lie. There's no need to. She told it because liars lie. It's what liars do. So they just lie because they just lie. And so by listening to them repeatedly, you can see the inconsistencies and the deviations that occur. And they can frequently be very illuminating in seeing where the lies are and what's a lie. You can then compare each retelling of the story with the previous ones. But the thing is, as well, instead of focusing on the obviously important issues or events, when you're re-interviewing, instead of focusing on the obviously important issues and events which they're better able to remember, try instead to focus on the minor details, the tiny details, which they're not making as much effort to remember, and seek to draw them out about those things. And that's where they're more likely to trip themselves up, because in relation to the bigger, more substantive parts of the story, they will have made a bigger effort to memorize the lie. But in relation to the trivial detail, they will have made less effort to memorize the lie. So when they tell that part of the lie again, that's often where the discrepancies will be, in the detail, the smaller details. And another point is, if at a later stage, on say the third or fourth interview, you point out one of these discrepancies, what you'll frequently find is that the person will then try to dig themselves out of it, and they'll tell another lie to get out of that lie. And this is frequently how you can catch them out. Remember, what's your purpose? What's your objective here? Your objective is to find out who's lying to you. What you then do with that is another question. But your objective is to find out who's lying and where are they lying and what are they lying about. Later, you may choose to do any number of things about that. But here's what you're trying to do at this point, is to find out whether they're lying. And so you can use this in a workplace, in a church. So I'll just make another point, just to conclude on this section, is this. Truthful people also make errors. Truthful people also have gaps in their evidence or points on which they're hazy. But when truthful people make errors or can't remember things or have gaps in their knowledge or they're hazy about things, it sounds different. For one thing, they openly admit that they're unsure about certain facts, or they openly admit that they can't remember the precise sequence of events. They'll just say what they do know, but they'll also say what they don't know. And when they're speaking about what they don't know, they'll say, "I don't know." And they'll even say that when it harms their own case, or where, from their perspective, it's regrettable that they don't know. But what they won't do is try and fill up the gaps. So, but by contrast, when a liar tells lies in his story, it sounds different, because he tells those lies without realizing it. And without remembering what he told before. He doesn't remember that he's saying something different from before. And he will also, when telling the lie, even telling the second version of it, he'll purport to be confident of his facts, and he won't express doubts about the things he's lying to you about. Whereas the honest person, when being questioned exactly what's, you know, did he come into the room before him or after him? Oh dear, now let me think. Can't really remember. I know they both came in. They won't try and add the missing ingredients. They'll just tell you what they don't know and what they do know. So that will help you to distinguish between that, which is coming from a genuine person, and the other, which is coming from a liar. So here's another point, which helps you to identify a wrongdoer or a liar, is look for momentary panic in people's eyes when they are asked about a certain thing or something is discussed. If you see panic in the person's eyes just as that thing is mentioned or spoken of, then dig deeper to find out what's bothering them or what are they hiding about that thing. So Take careful note, therefore, whenever you see that sudden look of fear or panic. You don't necessarily know why there's fear or panic, but you know there's fear or panic, and you know there's something to dig into. There must be something here that's sensitive for some reason or other. Now, sometimes the sensitivity of it will be obvious. You might be asking them about some terrible trauma that's happened to them. You know, tell me about the time when you were attacked in the street, and the person looks frightened when they begin to think about it. Well, it's pretty obvious why they look frightened and anxious, because they were attacked in the street and they're talking about it. But I'm talking about something where, on the face of it, there's no reason why they should be afraid or panicking, and yet they do. It's that that you need to take note of, not where there's obviously good reason to be afraid or panic, where you're giving, or where you're giving bad news to someone, they might panic. But then it's obvious why they're panicking or being afraid. But I'm talking about situations where, on the face of it, you can see no reason why that should make them panic. So you're wanting to know, what's behind this? Why is that sudden, unexplained flash of fear? What's it about? And the chances are, something is happening that you don't know about, but which they know about, which is causing them alarm. And you need to know about that, because finding out about that may unravel another part of the evidence that you're trying to deal with. Because remember, the whole world would be a lot simpler if everybody just told the total truth to everybody the whole time, wouldn't it? If that was the case, we wouldn't need any of this, would we? But the fact is, the world isn't like that, so you do need these kind of things. Now, an example of this, just in a workplace context, I once employed two people. I'm calling them Fergus and Malcolm. Now, Fergus was wanted to be a trainee solicitor, and so did Malcolm. And they were both ex-employees of mine years ago. And the thing was that Fergus, they were both Christians, or meant to be. Fergus, I asked Fergus to help to look after Malcolm. Malcolm came to me in a very damaged condition. He'd had a very difficult upbringing, very, very traumatized background. I wanted to help him to make something of his life. I gave him a job with me, and I wanted him to get himself back together again. And I asked Fergus to help him out. I asked Fergus to mentor him, look after him, help build confidence in him. Fergus wanted to go into ministry one day. That was his objective. And I thought Fergus would be an ideal person to look after Malcolm. Anyway, the point is this. One particular day, I was with Malcolm, and he was going through some difficulties again. He was having problems. And I said to him, what you need to do, spend some more time with Fergus. And just as I said that, into Malcolm's eyes came a look of alarm and panic. And I thought, that's strange. Why has Malcolm's face suddenly frozen with panic when I mentioned spending more time with Fergus? What's all that about? Remember, at this time, I'm completely clueless. I have no idea what's going on. All I know is that when I mentioned spend more time with Fergus, Malcolm's face freezes with panic. And then it went away. And remember, it's only momentary. People don't tend to just hang there in suspended animation for 20 minutes while you gape at their panic-stricken face. These things are momentary. You see them for a flash, and then they're gone. And then you begin to doubt yourself. Did I see that? Did I really see that? Well, that's where you need to have the confidence. Don't doubt yourself. If you think you saw panic on a person's face, you very, very probably saw panic on a person's face, even if they deny it. I'll explain that a little more later. So, when I saw that, I didn't question Malcolm at that point, but I took note of his reaction. And later I questioned him. And initially, when I began to question him, he said everything was fine, no problem. But I knew he was hiding something from me about Fergus. I knew something was wrong. But I kept pressing, gently pressing at him. And eventually, Malcolm revealed that Fergus was a real problem to him. He was effectively bullying him, taking advantage of him. He was using him. He was not mentoring him at all. He was actually, in many ways, a real hindrance to him. And he didn't want to be with Fergus. And this is the person I've given him to mentor him. Fergus was a very false young man. Very false. I write about him elsewhere in Book 6. He was a real nasty piece. And he Malcolm dreaded spending even more time with Fergus, but here am I, the boss of this place, completely clueless about this. Do you see? This is the point. The one who's the boss will probably know the least. So I've diagnosed that what Malcolm needs is plenty of help from Fergus. And what I'm giving him is the worst possible thing to give him. But I didn't know. Now, if I had ignored that flash of fear and panic on Malcolm's face, I wouldn't have seen through that problem. I wouldn't have got to the heart of it. But when we did get to the heart of it, I then began to check into it. What is Fergus doing? And there were all sorts of things he was doing. And in the end, I investigated him and we went through a disciplinary procedure. And I would have sacked him, except that he asked if he could resign. So he did resign. But if he hadn't have resigned, he would have been sacked within a week or two. He was a bad one. But no one had made a complaint. Nothing had been brought to my attention about that until I saw that look of panic. Now, that's what I mean by pull on a thread on a cardigan. If you see a problem, open, just take note of it and begin to turn over other stones. And that's when things come. Let me tell you about another way in which I used this thing about panic in people's faces. When I was a policeman back in the 1980s, I used this technique of looking in people's faces for panic to enable me to get a vastly disproportionately high number of motoring offences. I caught no end of drivers. The roads of Britain are safe to drive on now if you're a criminal, now that I'm not out there doing this. But this is a technique I developed. And I believe God gave it to me. I asked God to help me to catch people. And, Jeremiah 33:3. Call to me and I will answer you and tell you great and hidden things which you have not known. If you call on him, he will give you information. He will give you wisdom. He'll give you ideas. And I asked him to help me to catch guilty motorists. And this is the idea that came to me. It's quite simple, but it was amazingly effective. And what I used to do in the town that I was in at that time, there was a main road, it came around a sharp corner, and then shortly after the sharp corner was a zebra crossing. Now, for American people listening, that's a place where pedestrians are allowed to cross and the motorists have to stop. And I stood on the far side of this zebra crossing, and I used to watch the motorists coming round on this main road, and I just used to stare at their faces. And as they came round the corner, they had the horrific sight of me standing in uniform just on the far side of the zebra crossing. And I would watch them one after another. I'd just look into their eyes and maybe 15 or 20 would pass by, quite happy, no look of panic in their face. But then maybe 1 in 20, 1 in 30 would pass by and I'd see a look of instant, momentary panic in their face when they saw me. And those, I immediately put my hand in the air, stopped them, made them stop. They were going slowly because they were coming around a corner anyway. And I pulled them into a little taxi rank that was just conveniently nearby. It was a perfect place, just designed for me. And so I pulled them in and checked them out. And do you know, the number of drink drivers I got was amazing. And if they weren't drink drivers, it was something else. But the correlation between panic in the eyes and something murky going on was extremely strong. And because of this technique that I had, I got a huge number of convictions by doing this. And I used to bring in drink drivers, breathalyzer cases all the time. I got more breathalyzers than the whole of the rest of my shift put together. And other things too, of that kind. And you could stand there for just an hour and catch no end. You know, it was like fishing in Galilee with Jesus helping. You'd pull them in, 153 fish, and then go and have your lunch. And it was just that easy by using this technique. And the point is, and it's because of the way God has designed us. And let me explain it a little more closely in the last few minutes. You need to pay close attention to people's facial expressions and tone of voice and place more reliance on those than on the actual literal words that people say. So if those don't match up, if the words don't match the tone or the face, trust the face and trust the tone, don't trust the words. If there's a mismatch, trust the face. And the reason for that is this: God has designed us the human body and face, the electrical wiring that's inside us. If you've got an electrician to look at it, thank you. There is wiring going from your face to your emotions, to your mind, and the things you're thinking and the things you're feeling instantaneously produce, you're programmed to produce expressions on your face to reflect what you're thinking and feeling. God designed us that way. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to do a thing. Your face just automatically is working the whole time to produce expressions which are consistent with your thoughts and feelings. You don't have to do a thing about it. You're wired up. It's automatic. It's unconscious. Now, the thing is this. The only people who know how to replicate this artificially are trained actors and confidence tricksters and fraudsters and people like that. But if it's some trained actor, you know, a trained actor, you could say to him, right, I want you now, this is the part of the script we're dealing with. You've just learned that you've been bereaved, one of your parents has just died. I want you to show that in your reactions, in your face, as you're reading out these words. All right? Perhaps you're on an audition or something like that. The director wants to see how you pull that off. And there you are. This trained actor can show grief on his face. He can show anguish on his face, even though he isn't feeling any anguish or any grief at all. It's all acting. Now, the point is, he can do that because he's got the gift of acting, which is a God-given gift in the first place, and he's also been trained for years in how to do it. But the average Joe that you're going to come across is not a trained actor from the Royal Shakespeare Company. He can't do that. And therefore, what it means is this. He will lie to you with his words, but his face can't match it because he doesn't know how to control his face. And therefore, his words will be saying one thing, but his face will be saying another thing. Now, this is why you need to have the confidence to believe what you see in his face and what you hear in his tone and what you also see in his body language and posture. Now, the wicked, they find it very easy to lie with their words, but they don't have the skill to manipulate and maneuver their faces at will. You know, they don't know how to, because all of this is done automatically. Unless you have found a way through intense training at drama college to learn how to replicate it artificially. But even then, I would say this. If you got even a great actor and he's playing the scene of a bereaved person or an angry person or a happy person or whatever it is, and show him against film of a real person doing that same emotion on their face automatically, I think you'll find there'll be discrepancies, and the real thing on a real person's face when it's really happening will be slightly different from how the actor portrays it. But be that as it may, the point is 99.9% of people are not trained actors. So when the person is saying something and their face doesn't match up, trust your instinct about their face. And the reason I say that is because the same God who created the wiring that goes from the face to the emotions and from the face to the head, to the mind, the same God who created that wiring and that software program to do all that, he also put into each of us another software program, which is what I call face recognition software. And God has built into us a face recognition software package. It's all put in at the factory. You don't have to do a thing about it. You don't have to learn it. It's completely automatic and instinctive. So what you call instinct or a hunch is actually more properly described as your use of the software package that God very graciously gave to you when he manufactured you. And so he put into you a way of interpreting faces. That's why little babies know how, they understand faces. They know what faces are saying. God made us to understand faces. And the reason I stress this is because most people have trained themselves to not believe that their own instincts are right. They believe people's words over their own instinct. So they'll accept the person's assurance rather than rely on their own instinct about what the face was showing. So the face, for example, might show anger, but the person is saying they're not angry. The face shows resentment, but the person says they're not resentful. The face shows fear, but they say they're not afraid. And you'll doubt it because you think, well, how can I be right and they be wrong? I must be wrong. You'll also doubt it because The thing that you saw was only for a quarter of a second, half a second. The facial movements, all the configuration of facial muscles, imagine the software, but it's all very momentary. But it triggers a signal in you, and you can see it, you compute it, you read it, that signal, you form a view, he's afraid, he's angry, he's resentful, he's this, he's that. But his words are saying something else. And what I'm saying is, when you see a mismatch, believe that your interpretation of the face, don't believe their words. Or at any rate, let's put it this way. Reserve judgment and say, I'm going to look into this more closely because I'm conscious of there being a mismatch between your face and your words, and I want to turn over several more stones. I'm just dubious about all this. I'm going to carry out an investigation. You didn't say all this out loud. You say it to yourself. I'm going to carry out an investigation and check out, why does your face not match your words? And I'm not going to cast aside the high quality facial recognition software system that God gave to me. I'm not going to consider it invalid or it doesn't work properly or just write it off. I'm going to say, no, it's a good quality software package, and I'm going to place a degree of reliance upon it. But I'm not going to rely solely on that. I'm also going to turn over many, many stones and see what those stones turn up. Do they corroborate my instinct or do they not? And when you turn over the stones, as I did with Malcolm, I found out that what I saw in his face was true, and what he was saying with his mouth was not true, because he was denying it at first. No, everything's fine. But later, he admitted it wasn't fine. Now, what if I'd believed his words and not believed his face? So, where are we? If I can just go for a few more minutes, I could finish this section. Would that be all right? Only for a few more minutes. Because on this same theme, I'm reminded of something that Winston Churchill once said. And it's on this business of how things are said. It's tone of voice this time, as opposed to faces. Now, Churchill served for a time in World War I in the Grenadier Guards. And he was saying in one book that he wrote, he said that it's a tradition in the Grenadier Guards that all orders are to be responded to with a single word, sir. You just say, sir, whatever the order is. And in the 101st Airborne Division, they're slightly more generous than that. They allow three responses. You can say, yes, sir, no, sir, and no excuse, sir. And those are the only responses that are allowed. Now, in the Grenadier Guards, you just say, sir. Whenever anything, you're told to do anything, immediately you just say, sir. But this is what Winston said. He's quite dry the way he says things. And he said, that's what you have to do. He said, however, whereas the soldier has to obey, he does not necessarily have to express enthusiasm. And then Churchill said, and all kinds of inflections may be given to this monosyllable. So the way someone says the word sir, you can inject into that expression all sorts of different meanings about whether you approve of it, disapprove of it, you're enthusiastic, you think the officer is being an idiot, they think this is the most crazy thing you've seen ever, or any other number of thoughts can be given just to the way you say the word sir. And the thing is as well, the same software system that's given to the human face, and also don't forget hands and body and posture, it's all linked up, and the same recognition system is also applicable to the tone of the voice. The voice conveys things, and you need to trust that your software works correctly. Don't write it off and say, oh no, I very much doubt that I could possibly accurately interpret anything. I'm just going to believe what people tell me. So the thing is that people will lie to you with their words, but their tone will often give them away. Frequently give them away, and you need to have the confidence to interpret that. Not only the face, the eyes, in particular the eyes, tone, posture, hand mannerisms, all those things will give you the clue that the person is telling you a lie at this point. That doesn't mean you form a conclusion and say, right, at this point I now suspend the entire investigation. I've seen enough. I've seen a look on your face. And as a consequence of that, I'm terminating the entire inquiry and relying solely on that one point. No, of course you don't do that. But what you do is In reliance upon that, you turn over a whole load of other stones and see what earwigs crawl out from underneath those. So, where am I? So no system is infallible. I mean, I do want to emphasize this. Although God made the software, he did make the software, and it was well manufactured, but it's inside us, and we've got a sin nature, and in all sorts of other ways we've fallen away, and we're damaged and tarnished in the way we operate. And on top of all that, the system isn't infallible because you're being deceived by demons half the time, and you've got your own wrong ideas, and other people have deceived you about things. So there's all sorts of other things that may cause you to misconstrue even what you see. But this is true. Even if your instincts do guide you wrongly at times, such that you pick up vibes that aren't really there, it's certainly true that you'll make fewer errors by taking your instinctive impressions into account than by refusing to do so. So if you instead rely solely on the plain, literal, actual words that people say to you, you're going to be a sitting duck for deceivers, because you've switched off one of God's God-given mechanisms to help you to discern things. And the point is, it's meant to be used alongside other tests, not in total disregard of other tests or in isolation. So God did not intend for us to rely solely on this mechanism of looking at faces, posture, tone of voice. Of course he doesn't. But neither does he want us to switch it off altogether. And you need to have the confidence to use it in conjunction with all the other tests that you'll be using. So this is what I thought I could do today in addition to what I've been doing. See? Look at that. Anyway, I'll stop at that point and we'll resume at the next meeting. Thank you.